Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with two experts on community health programs, one of the nation's many federally qualified health centers. Community health programs provide high-quality health care to all comers, regardless of income, insurance, or immigration status. Like many, FQHCS CHP has its roots in the civil rights movement, which included civic efforts to ensure that all Americans have access. Today, there are more than 1,100 FQHCs nationwide in our region. The Berkshire County Healthcare Network serves more than 22,000 people with primary care, women's health care, dental care, ophthalmology, physical therapy, nutrition, and family support services. Joining us today, and we are so lucky to have both of them, is Leah Spiliotis, the Chief Executive Officer at Community Health Programs. Leah was CHP's interim CEO for a year, following interim positions at other federally qualified health centers. She has an extensive track record in healthcare policy and regulatory issues, and was for many years a partner with Cambridge Management Group. Spiliotis earned her bachelor's degree with a concentration in neuroscience from Smith College and a degree in management from MIT's Sloan School of Management. She's been at work in the healthcare industry for 30 years. She's also been honored recently as a board member of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Also joining us today is one of our great heroes, and frankly, the reason I wanted to do this show, and that is Linda Small. Linda joined CHP as education coordinator in 1974 when CHP was Children's Health Program. She was named executive director in 1983, a job she held until 2004. During those 3 decades, the U.S. healthcare system changed dramatically, along with CHP, which expanded to serve patients of all ages. Linda served in many volunteer capacities in the Berkshires and received numerous awards, deserved, believe me, and recognition for her community service. She is now retired and living down east in Port Clyde, Maine. She's a graduate of Bennington College and Antioch University, Cambridge College, where she earned her master's in administration and social work. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
And Linda, thanks for being here.
Delighted to be back in the Berkshires.
Linda, I'm going to start with you because it brings tears to my eyes, and I mean that, when I remember how all of this started. There was a wonderful man named Tom Whitfield.
That's right. I call him pediatrician extraordinaire because he had the soul of a saint and was devoted to the care of children. And as you may remember, Alan, he moved here in 74 to open a small practice on the Hill in his home office.
A pediatrician practice.
A pediatric practice, yes. That's right. And almost immediately, because we had had no pediatric care in South Berkshire at that point, he began seeing children who came to him, as I remember him telling, so ill and so in need of care, and having gotten very ill because they had no care, that he was immediately realizing this was not going to be an ordinary pediatric practice. He immediately teamed up with Jean Massimiano, who ran something called the Western Mass Health Planning Council. She had done a needs assessment study that said South Berkshire was in desperate need of care for elders and for children under 5. So the two of them got together and decided they would start a well child practice. And Tom had the idea that instead of expecting the children to come to him, he would take the care to the children. And they sort of rooted around for a while and got $5,000 from Mary England and the Berkshire Council for Children. All of these institutions have now disappeared. And so they started in 1975, March. And I, reading about them in the newspaper, wrote a letter and said I would love to join them and bring educational services to the children as well as the medical and healthcare services. Little did I know what I was getting into. Median income when we started was $7,950 in South Berkshire. I think that's a sort of startling statistic. Uh-huh. There were 500 children that we thought lived in the 9 towns that we called South Berkshire at that point. So our target was to find all 500 children under 5 years of age. And that entailed doing home visits, driving up and down backcountry roads, looking for diapers on the line and Hot Wheels in the yards and any sign that there might be a young child in the house, and then stopping and knocking on the door. And it was that critical piece of making sure that we found every child that I think distinguished CHP's beginning years. And out of that grew all the services that CHP really continues. Outstanding health care. The WIC program came on board very early and was a critical piece because of a social history that I had no idea about.
Women, children, and infants.
Women, infants, and children. A nutrition program that provides high-protein diets to pregnant women, lactating women, and children up until they're 5 years of age. It was critical because prior to the year when we got welfare, aid for dependent children didn't come into being until the 60s. And prior to that time, the board of selectmen in each town were responsible for people who were poor. Mm-hmm. And in many towns, what we had were poor farms. But what they discovered was that the state of Massachusetts would offer children who had special ed problems residence in state schools for $1 a day. And of course, what a special ed problem could be was pretty vast. And so what happened was that a lot of children got taken out of families in the Berkshires and sent to Belchertown State School, where they became what we call institutionalized. They had problems that came from being in an institution, not being in their families. We had no notion that this was what we were into. Mm-hmm. But needless to say, seeing somebody come knocking on your door and saying that you were interested in your children was enough to make many doors close. They would open them sometimes and talk to you through a crack, but they were not about to let you near their children. And it was the WIC program that turned that around, mm-hmm. because we got one of the first WIC contracts in the state of Massachusetts. And in the old days, we contracted with a dairy in Pittsfield to deliver the WIC foods to the homes. And all of a sudden, that changed message gave us entree into the homes of families all across South Berkshire. Because the next day, here comes the dairy ban with eggs and cheese and milk for the family. Now, WIC has grown. It's now a very different kind of program. The range of foods has been expanded. But I can't overemphasize how critical it was in reassuring families in South Berkshire that we really were there for the kids.
A little more talk about Tom Whitfield, who I feel so close to. Yeah. He's gone now, long gone. But he was really committed to this. And I remember a particular story in which some of the other pediatricians in town were here for, you know, practice, regular practice. He was furious about that. He wanted them to give part of their time to the program. And boy, was he angry about that.
Happily, they reconciled.
Yes, I know.
At the end. And that was sweet. But it was difficult. And people always thought that CHP must have paid Tom a fortune. We never paid him a dime.
Oh, sure.
Everything he did.
He was the best of Americans. Yeah. He really was. Yeah, really great. So it has quite a history. And this part of ours, we're sitting in Great Barrington recording this right now, is so grateful for what happened. But let's talk a little bit about what did happen and how this program emerged to where it is now. So let's talk to Leah Spiliotis about how this thing developed from the very beginning into this powerhouse that it is now. And what is it now? It started in South Berkshire, but now it's all over the place.
Well, presently we have 9 health centers. They're not all medical centers, primary care practices. Only 5 of them are. We have 2 dental practices. One of the dental practices in Pittsfield that we just acquired also has a dental residency program that we have in collaboration with Berkshire Medical Center. We have an OBGYN, an obstetric and gynecology practice in Great Barrington, which was also a practice that we expanded into and got a substantial grant for. And then we have family services, which is very, very large. So Family Service is a WIC program and other supports to family and children. They do the food pantry. I mean, I would say every time I have them do a presentation for me, they bring out 17 slides to talk about all the different programs that they have. But
So, Leah, what does this cost? What's the total budget for all of this?
We're at about $17 million. We were, I think, 8 in 2005, and now we're 17. And I have a goal to double our size in 5 years. I think that's possible.
And who gives the money?
Well, we have a very small percentage of our budget. And I say small because I run other health centers. About 20% of our budget is from the federal government. It's called a 330 grant, and that's what supports the federally qualified health centers across the United States.
I have to stop you right there and ask you whether this is in danger, considering all of the proposed cuts to health care that we have seen out of the Trump administration.
Well, nobody knows how it's going to end up, but I was just looking at some things that came across my desk. And, you know, it's quite scary. There is federal monies to the tune of $78 million that expire on October 1st. And if those monies expire, at least in Massachusetts, where we service about 985,000 patients, we haven't cracked a million yet, 60,000 or so of those individuals will lose their health care. So it is substantial what could happen. We could lose our enhanced rate, and by that I mean federally qualified health centers. If a regular doctor gets paid $68 a visit, we get paid $162 a visit. And so the chances are that we could lose that enhanced funding for our population. I think it all remains to be seen. I'm not the biggest political maven, but what I do know is there are a lot of people who are up for re-election in the midterm elections, and a lot of those folks have constituencies that would be very negatively affected, both Medicare and Medicaid. So I would say stay tuned.
Well, it's hard to believe that people who represent Western Massachusetts congressmen are not on board already.
They're totally on board. All of our representatives and our state senator. And we've been very fortunate. I think as a state, Massachusetts, I was just at a meeting where Secretary Mary Lou Sutters was there. And as a state, we are so far ahead of the other states in some of the provisions that we've made that even if the federal government changes its mind on some things, we have provisions within the state that we'll be able to carry forward.
That's great. So I want to go back to you and ask you this question, and Linda Small, and that is, what do you see up in Maine that you can reference against your experience in Great Barrington?
Well, first of all, the dimensions of the space. I mean, people have heard me for years talk about rural South Berkshire, and rural South Berkshire was, I think, 326 square miles when I left. The county I live in now, Knox County, which has a desperate need for a community health center, has 350 square miles of land, and we're responsible for 750 square miles of ocean.
How many people?
Not very many spread across that. Probably in the order of maybe 20,000 spread over that. But you have to remember that in Maine, many of our people earn their living on that 750 square mile of ocean. It includes the islands, Monhegan. So it is just mind-boggling to me to think about how you would design health care to serve that population. We have a terrible opioid addiction problem, and I don't think it's going to get solved until we can provide primary health care to the residents of Maine. And I'm very concerned about it. I don't have the same kind of platform that I had in South Berkshire to make a difference, but I continue to work where I can to see if we cannot somehow bring some real primary care services. And that was always the beauty of Tom Whitfield's vision, was he knew that if you started early and got families enrolled in their own health care, and he was really good about that, that it would make such a difference throughout their lives. We never had research dollars to prove that what we did made a difference, because it would have meant a lot of finagling with numbers and families, and we were not committed to doing that. The reason we wanted to be a community health center were all the reasons that Leah just described, because of the enhanced rate. We could put a real financial backing. And I was talking to Leah and Ellen this morning about the fact that for a long time, we were just a year-to-year kind of program. We didn't think of ourselves as long-term. But as the children grew older and the parents came to us and said, we need you to see 12-year-olds. We need you to see 18-year-olds. My son has a medical problem. I need you to take care of him through his lifetime. We began to realize we had a long-term obligation to this population. And that's when becoming a community health center became very real. And happily, the regulations and the rules governing how you did that changed enough that we could begin to attach our hopes to that particular program. And what Leah just said confirms to me that that was the right decision. We stepped off into a void. We didn't know how we were going to do it, but with a lot of collaborators, and as you know, CHP grew a huge community of collaborators, including—
When you say collaborators, what do you mean?
Berkshire Health Systems. When I needed to get a clinic, when I needed to get a clinic so I could have clinic licensure, Claire Bowen was the one who was the chief executive officer at Fairview,
the local hospital in Great Barrington.
Yeah, who said, "I think we can put you on the fourth floor," and up we went. And on October 1997, we had the licensure in our hand, and we had Tom Whitfield and Jean Masmiano. Tom, at that point, was under treatment for the lung cancer. They both got to see that we now had a licensed clinic. Getting the Medicaid and Medicare billing numbers was a bit more of a trick, but we knew we now had a future. And I think for both of them, it was a dream come true that now we could serve everybody. Mm-hmm. And I can remember going to Price Chopper one day, and the gentleman who was bagging the groceries said, "You know, I was in terrible shape with diabetes, and I've been to your clinic." And he said, "I've lost 50 pounds, and my blood sugars are now down where they're supposed to be, and I'm feeling much better." You didn't need any more than that.
Well, Elias Biliotis, the question for you then is, you know, you're great in terms of telling us the nuts and bolts, but in the same way that we've just heard a story about a single kid who does well, are you finding any of that yourself, that there are exemplary stories that make us understand what this thing is all about?
I think there are exemplary stories that do, in fact, showcase not only the families, but also the staff. And I would always say my heart is touched the most by stories that come out of the family services portion of it. I mean, there are always stories that I hear about patients who came in and they have some chronic disease or a couple of chronic diseases, and they really love their doctor and their doctors help them along. But the stories that I hear are the families that are the immigrant families that are afraid to show up, but they do show up, and they need medical treatments and they need dental treatments and they need to feel safe. And what we've done is we've integrated the family services within the medical component of it, so that now there are, in the same way that there are warm handoffs to behavioral health from medicine, we have warm handoffs from family services to the clinics, so that that way these families that come can feel embraced all the way around, from knowing where they're going to be able to get some food, where their kids are going to get their teeth taken care of, whatever concerns or fears that they have. You know, we have very much have supported them.
Yes, but is there a story?
Is there a story that makes me weep? Well, there was a story that did make me weep. It was a story about a woman who traveled from North Carolina with her child to escape an abusive situation, and she found her way to Family Services in the same moment that there was a reporter at Family Services. So my hair on my arm is going up. But in any event, they managed to get kind of the situation stabilized. They managed to get medical care for the kid, and the mother was being taken care of. And they worked with that family for quite some time. I don't know how many weeks it was that they worked with this family. But subsequent to that, I was outside at one of these food banks that they were having. And the woman was there with her child, with her husband. Now talk about being able to mend things. That to me just gives me shivers.
Yeah.
Because I kept on saying, is that the husband? Yeah, that's the husband. Like, wow. But they just embrace you. Family Services just embraces you, and our medical staff embraces you, and they deal with whatever it is that they have to deal with in the moment, and then they just keep on going like the Ever-Ready Bunny.
Well, as you guys know, there is an elephant on the table as we speak today. And the elephant on the table, of course, is the ACA, or the Obamacare, as some people like to call it, which the President of the United States is determined, bound and determined, to do away with. Mm-hmm. How does that affect you, Leah?
Well, certainly, should we find ourselves in a situation where we don't have the enhanced rates, which will be in existence for a while. The two major values of being in a federally qualified center are an enhanced rate, so that every time you see someone, you make a lot more than the private physician. And there's no malpractice. We're covered under the Federal Torts Act, right. Claims Act. So those are an incentive for folks to come to flock
to doctors,
to doctors. And that's how we got these practices that sort of sit through South and North County, is we got them because the doctors couldn't, their practices were financially failing. And so coming under an FQHC umbrella made them a lot better. One of the things that's happening as a part of the accountable care organizations that have formed right now, just to address the Medicaid population, is that
that's the poorer population, Medicaid.
The Medicaid population, of which we have about 40% of our population are Medicaid. We're moving to value-based payments. And so what that means is that they're going to look at what it costs to take care of people and then give capitated payments. In some ways, it's very reminiscent of managed care days, except with a little bit of a twist, because now we, community health programs, are in an accountable care organization with Berkshire Health Systems called Health Collaborative of the Berkshires, in addition to Fallon Health. So we are a threesome that have developed this. This is our ACO out here in the Berkshires, and others have developed them in the eastern part of the state and elsewhere. So we're going to be moving to a slightly different model of payment. So on the one hand, you don't want to lose your enhanced payment. On the other hand, if you're going to a data-driven, this is how much it costs to take care of your patient, and you're going to get this money, we have to split it up, so that's why we have to work together. I'm a little bit more hopeful that financially we will be able to survive. And if we run our business efficiently, in fact, do quite well.
Let me ask you a question. Somebody's screaming at the radio right now. Why should you get enhanced payments? Why shouldn't you just get what the doctors get?
Well, because the doctors don't take care of the types of patients that we do, who have many more things going on. We take care of the sicker patients, and that's always been true with federally qualified health centers. And they kind of get to pick and choose who they want. We take all comers. Even about 9% of our population are uninsured individuals, and we treat them.
Okay, so the bottom line, ACA goes away, Obamacare goes away, you can survive.
I think we can survive. And I'm an eternal optimist, but I believe we can survive. We just have to do the right things.
Linda Small, I want to let you know, as a person who is very concerned with healthcare and the economics of healthcare, I want to ask you to tell us what you think of what President Trump is, in my mind, inexplicably doing.
Well, I share Leah's concerns, because once we decided that we were a long-term solution to a problem in Southern Berkshire, and then, as it turned out, after I left, to a Berkshire County solution, once we came to that understanding, it became very clear that despite what I consider a lot of very difficult negotiations, if you are a federally qualified community health center, there's a lot of moving parts to it. And I congratulate CHP on getting Leah at the helm, because she has an understanding about how difficult that is and knows how to make it work.
Yeah.
But my concern is that we keep talking about ACA as an insurance problem, but it is a major rural health issue. And I, coming from Maine now, where my definition of rural has expanded voluminously, I'm really concerned about that. We could potentially lose rural hospitals, rural healthcare providers. And we're in Maine.
You mean with the collapse of ACA?
Yes, because there's a relationship between who provides healthcare and how it's funded. And physicians are not going to be able to manage a private practice very well.
No.
And in rural areas where they're having to pick up the very ill as well as the less ill patients, they're going to suddenly see their bottom line is just not workable. And rural hospitals are going to be in the same boat.
Wait, so are you guys in disagreement with each other? You say you'll survive, Leah, Linda?
Well, I think it's a question of scale. Yeah. No, I think it varies where you are in the state or in other states in terms of location. So if you are in a rural area, you're never going to be able to scale your business to the point where you could at least even break even. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with Linda that in that kind of a situation, it's the death knell.
But with your operation, I want to be a little more insistent on this. With your operation, let's assume the Senate goes along, ACA disappears as we know it right now. What individual components of your program will suffer or might suffer?
Well, if the ACA goes away, a lot of the enhancements to the programs, I mean, maybe we won't be able to keep as much staff on hand to service the community. Certainly, we might not be able to. We service 15% of the county, which is great, but it's not that much. There's 85%, which we would never be able to service all 85%. But that means that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to go without health care. We just won't be able to take them in.
Have you heard from any of those people?
Not yet.
You will?
I know.
Okay. And Linda, because you are a sagacious and wise person, when I wake up in the morning and I think Donald Trump is the president of the United States, and he's trying to screw people out of their health care, put any other way, could you make any sense out of any of this?
Well, Alan, as I learned in South Berkshire many, many years ago from Dr. Thomas J. Whitfield, you do what you can. And I have great faith in communities coming together and finding solutions that will work. Now, goodness knows an FQHC is a mix of federal and state and local and private fundraising. And so there are all of these pieces. I think I get worried too, but then I remember how communities work. And this community, whenever we had a fiscal shortfall, and it used to be sort of year to year, and maybe we needed $5,000, and I can remember the parents came to us and said, you know, you could raise money doing a bike-a-thon. And I said, how do you do that? And they said, well, you have kids ride their bicycles and they get pledges for so many miles. And I said, can you organize it? Yeah, we'll do it. So they organized a bike-a-thon, first at Mount Everett and then at Monument. And what we didn't count on was that little rural kids, when they finally had a huge parking lot to ride in, would ride for 2 or 3 hours and come in with these pledges of $10 per mile from grandma. Now, grandma suddenly discovered that they'd ridden 30 miles, decided maybe she didn't invest quite that much money. So we had to change the rules a little bit so that grandma could just pledge one amount and it wasn't pegged to how many miles those little ones could go. But any number of children learned to ride bicycles riding in our bike-a-thons. And I was explaining to Leah this morning, the money came in pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters. And $5,000 in pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters is a lot of weight. And it took us about a week to check it all out and roll it and take it to the bank. But those were the kinds of ways that in the children's attic, which is going on this weekend, it's the same thing.
And what is the children's attic?
Families bring the stuff that they would like to sell and sell it under a tent, and then they get a percentage of the proceeds, and CHP gets a percentage of the proceeds, and this is the 28th year of doing it. And I'm like, you know, this is the answer to politics on the national level. Is communities are resilient, they're responsible. When they see that they've got something good, they're going to rise up.
Yeah, but wouldn't Donald Trump endorse what you're saying right now and say, yeah, you don't need all this federal stuff.
Well,
all you need is to get together as a community.
Well, absolutely. That's exactly his mantra, but we know he doesn't believe it with any degree of responsiveness. But I think that the message there always is that we come together and we find mutual solutions.
So let me go to you, Leah, if I can. We have a wonderful group in the county called VIM, Volunteers in Medicine. These are people who used to practice medicine, but who now say, okay, well, I'll give back to the community. You find me my medical malpractice or whatever I have to worry about.
Right.
And I'm a dentist, a retired dentist. Or how do you get together with groups like that so that everybody is working towards the same goal?
So it's interesting. When I first came here back in 2015, I spent some time over there, and we actually have been actively looking at opportunities for us to work together, whereby, for example, we offer behavioral health services within each of our centers. And what
behavioral meaning psychiatric?
Yeah. Well,
counseling,
licensed social work, that kind of thing. And we have a lot of need, and we don't have as much individuals. We're also working collaboratively with the Breen. So what we've
Center, part of Berkshire County, and a place where
In Pittsfield,
addicted people go, and other
substance use. But VIM have social workers as well, and so we talked about with overflow, could we send some of our patients, and also they have bilingual social workers. So there's plenty of opportunity. It's just a question of figuring out the right thing to do.
So you guys, I'm sorry I'm so fixated on Trump, but I am. But I do want to ask you about that, because you just raised a very interesting subject to me. The infrastructure of our Southern Berkshire economy, without question, has a lot to do with undocumented aliens who are here, who come and need help. How does that affect you, Aaliyah, in terms of what you do?
Well, we treat them like every other patient that would come into the center, and we provide them services. And if they need any additional help, if they need, you know, help in finding places to live or whatever, we'll also pull in family services. But we treat them just like anybody else.
But don't you have to account to the federal government for who you're treating?
We account to the federal government for who we're treating on an annual basis, and it's all rolled up data.
So
they don't.
Data.
It's a violation of the Health Information Portability Act.
And how about HIPAA? You know, you're doing God's work here.
Yeah.
And you really have to be very careful about how you talk. I mean, doctors take this very seriously.
Yes.
So what do you do?
Well, number one, everything is in the electronic medical record, which is secured. Any communications
anything is capable of being secured these days?
Well, I'm sure somebody could hack into it, but to the degree that we can protect it, we do. And then we have secure messaging so that information going from doctor to doctor is not just like, I'm going to go talk to you in the hallway or slip you a piece of paper. So we look at all the different compliance areas for patient privacy and try to do the best we can.
Yeah. So, Linda, as a great social commentator, which I know you are, what about this immigration thing? Where are the intersections here that bother you or don't?
Well, my grandparents were immigrants from Denmark to Utah. So I have a strong feeling about immigration in this country, and I see it as an amazing benefit that cross-cultural practices. And I remember when we had our first immigrant patients coming to CHP, and somebody said, Linda, can we treat them? I said, we treat everybody. There's no discussion. We treat everybody. And I think that message is getting louder and clearer in this country. And I think we've had an aberration in a sense that we don't welcome immigrants. But I can remember Family Services when we did our first translator. Octavio is still with us.
Still here.
doing amazing work. We'd be so much poorer in Southern Berkshire and in Berkshire County without that wonderful energy that has come through the immigrant population. And why would we not serve them and welcome them and bring them into our resources? I can remember going when Claudette had family services down on South Main Street, and I went to a dinner one night where it was a group of women, all immigrants who were learning English. And they had come together and they were having a dinner party and singing their songs and telling their stories and learning English at the same time so they could all begin to find jobs in the Southern Berkshire economy. It was so amazing and the energy was so special. And I was like, this is a whole new world. This is a great thing to be part of.
Berkshire County is, of course, unique in America. I mean, I lived there, was talking from there today. Southern Berkshire can be pretty ritzy. On the other hand, there's a lot of hidden poor here, isn't mm-hmm. there?
I think there is. I think it's the people you don't see in the little towns in the hill. Yeah. You know, it's the people that you see that are the second homeowners or the ones that were second homeowners and now are full-time homeowners that you see. And, you know, hence, at least in our organization, we see this in Great Barrington, we see it in Lee, we see it less so at NHC, Neighborhood Health Center. We've got some 31-32% of our population that are commercial pay. Then those are the people like, I happen to be a client. You know, it really is a mix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the mix, of course, includes the city of Pittsfield.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to pick on Pittsfield, but
And Adams and North Adams.
Yes, and Adams and North Adams. These can be very trying cities to be able to deal with. I mean, we have shootings. We have a lot of police work. We have incredible amounts of addiction that are happening here. And I'm wondering if both of you, and I'm sure you see it in Maine, too, if both of you would be kind enough to tell us what the addiction thing has done to the provision of medical services. You want to start, Leah?
Sure. We are on the beginning part of the slope to deal directly with substance use. And as part of that, I made a decision that in order to do substance use and addiction properly, you really need to have wraparound services. You can't just give these antidotes that they give, naltrexone, Suboxone, any of those. I can teach my primary care physicians how to do that, but then what happens? So we've been just starting a dialogue between Berkshire Health System and the Breen Center and us on how we might look at taking a look at our population and providing some kind of a joint service. Because
like what? How would that look?
So what it would be is basically we would take our person and make sure they got hooked up in the right program at the Breen Center that has so many different ones. And whether they become inpatients or whether they go to a rehab house or whatever, but that they're actually seen and then handed off, and then ultimately they still would be our patient. But
well, do the docs have to be indoctrinated, for want of a better word?
They have to learn about it, and not all doctors want to do it. So there's some
that
do.
What do you mean they don't want to do it? Tell me about that.
I think it's because it's dealing with addiction. I think it's because anything can happen. I mean, I was in a situation in a previous health center that I ran, and I was cornered in a room by a guy that couldn't get his antidote because he had two prescriptions and had tried to take both of them in. And there I was, and I was with the doctor, and we were in that room for like an hour, and it scared the bejesus out of me. You know, it's
to say nothing of him.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons. And also, Linda, maybe you can talk to this a little bit. Isn't it also true that docs are not convinced that addiction is solvable?
Well, I think that may be the feeling of some of them. And I've seen docs. And I mean, I think it goes back to something that Tom Whitfield always believed, which was that's why you start with children when they're very small and you stay with that family through thick and thin, and there were other problems besides addiction. A family gets a diagnosis that a child has a special educational need or is going to face a handicapping condition throughout their lives. there are powerful emotional family moments whenever you start in pediatrics. And I'm a great believer in school-based health centers. I would love to see every school that has a population above a certain number with a little tiny health clinic with nurse practitioners and time, because one of the things that I think we keep doing is we keep shutting down the amount of time we have to give to kids at a time when they're very vulnerable to things like addiction. And it's a time when they need good information that comes from outside mom and dad telling them something, but somebody who's willing to listen to them. So I see that there are ways, but they're long-term preventive strategies. I mean, I love that we're working with the Breen Center, because Main Street Human Resources, which is part of the Breen Center, and CHP grew up together. And we grew up together making cross referrals and using one another's resources in a collaborative kind of way. And it meant the world to our families. So I think when families begin to see that there are avenues for health and that they can take on their responsibility for their health care, and we can be a supplement and a support to that process, you begin to see change. And I think that's how addiction is going to be solved. I don't think it's going to have a 1-2-3 solution. Yeah. It's going to have a long-term preventive health care process that will begin to detach people from the need for those substances.
So, Leah Spiliotis, so let me ask you this. If you had to quantify how important addiction is to the services that you provide, would it be at the top of the list or what?
No, I don't believe it would be at the top of our list. I think we have pockets of individuals that have strong addiction, substance use, alcohol use issues, but I believe that they are somewhat localized. And
really?
Yeah.
Because I open the paper in the morning and inevitably, it leads with, you know, somebody else being killed because of an alcohol addiction.
Right.
And that's got to get on your plate fast, doesn't it?
Well, it's there. It's there. And we're addressing it at this point in the way that we can medically and referring appropriately out to either the hospital or to the Breen Center. What we really have in spades is we have an older population. You know, Medicare is fairly large. We have individuals with comorbid conditions, so they'll have cardiac disease, they'll have diabetes, they'll have any number of things. And so those are the patients that are the sicker patients that take us longer to give care to. And so instead of being able to see 4 patients an hour or 3.5 patients an hour, you're barely squeaking in a second one. So I think we've been focused on dealing with an aging population, and one of the things that we need to focus on in future is to have gerontological support and skills in-house. I think that's going to be key for us.
And when you say gerontological, this is a 75-year-old asking you the question. What do you expect that those specialties will be able to do for you?
Well, part of it is a great sensitivity to not just the medical issues, but also the psychological issues, the social issues. I believe in whole care, and I think that when you get a gerontologist who's focused on that particular segment of the population, they know what whole care is. And it's not just how's your A1C doing for your diabetes, or, you know, your lipids look a little off, Mr. Chartok. It's like, so how are you living? How are you living? You know, those kinds of questions.
Right.
More of the social determinants, I would say, of health.
Exactly.
Right. So how does this, Leah, area, you've been in several doing this work.
Yes, I have.
How does this differ, this Berkshire County thing?
So it's very interesting. I always tell people this little story that there's a big difference in those 30 miles between exit 3 and exit 2. It almost be as if you're...
Seems like 70 to me.
Like you're driving across that long bridge when you're going down to the Keys. What I find here, and I've run health centers in the eastern part of the state and also in Pennsylvania, is the geological configuration has made it so that collaboration is not something that people have to think about to convince themselves to do it. It just is in the genes. And I found that in spades when I came here looking for opportunities to build relationships. I just like would call up and they're like, come on over, let's do something.
So Berkshire County is pretty special.
It's very, very special. It's very, very special.
Now you come from a Greek family.
I do.
And of course, my wife and I love Greece and we've been there a lot. The question would be, what does that do to you in terms of your receptivity to other immigrants?
Well, I am extremely receptive to other immigrants. I think.
Did you experience personal prejudice when you were growing up?
I did. My family were, my mother and father always said, you can only play with the Greeks because they were very ethnic. Play with the Greeks.
Well, and you can only marry a Greek.
And only marry a Greek. Well, you can only play with the Greeks when I was growing up, and the only Greeks in the town that we lived in was my family. Uh-huh. So we were surrounded by non-Greeks. And yeah, it was the typical, your father owns a pizza parlor, you know, I mean, they just, every single thing you could think of, they would throw at you. And so I really believe I was given an opportunity as a first generation to live the American dream, as were my brother and my brothers and my sister. And I believe that that should be a right for everybody that comes to this country. They should be allowed to do whatever it is that they need to do to advance themselves.
I want to ask you both a question. We're sort of running out of time here, but I want to ask you about the new medical models. I talk to a lot of GPs on my program, Medical Monday, and they always complain, maybe in private, maybe not on the air, that all of these medical practices that they used to have, an independent guy. We had a guy in town here, Tom Gilligan, who I love to this day, was my neighbor. He was the town doctor. He eventually honored as a great hero of Great Barrington. But those guys are gone. What's happening is the hospital comes in, they swoop over, they take over a medical practice. Now, I don't know if that's going on in Berkshire County, but I can tell you it's very dangerous. And then they say, here are our metrics. You have to see this. You mentioned it before. Mm-hmm. You have to see this many people in an hour. You can't spend more than 15 minutes with anybody and all the rest of that. How does that affect you?
Well, the most important underlying piece to that is to provide the doctors with the resources and the tools that actually work for them to do their job.
So give them a half an hour if they need a half an hour.
If they need a half an hour, they need a half an hour. But even more importantly, make sure that the electronic medical record works. You know, are there things that you can do to pre-populate the electronic medical records so that when the patient comes in, they go directly to see the doctor? We ran a pilot.
I'm sorry, I don't know what pre-populate
so
means.
So we ran a pilot where, and we actually, it's now throughout the center, where we call patients 3 days ahead of time. We go through the 7-page pre-registration. We get all the answers. We put it in the electronic medical record. The patient shows up for their office visit, and they go right in.
Has the doctor looked at it?
A lot of them, you know, half an hour before will, but they're not inputting it in that session, and the patient isn't putting it in the piece of paper when they're there. So we've saved 15, sometimes 20 minutes. I mean, unfortunately, one needs to think of efficiencies and resources in order to be able to see. If we don't see so many patients, then we can't at least break even or even run a surplus.
Now, Linda Small, you've already told us how your people landed, what, in Utah? Is that where they went to? Yeah, in Utah. And then you came here. But I've always seen you and your wonderful husband as sort of Yankees.
Alan, this conversation could go a lot of places. I had Danish grandparents in Utah. I had Southern grandparents on the other side in Alabama. And through my mother's peregrinations, I ended up growing up in Alabama, where I became acquainted with the rules of Jim Crow and poverty and a lot of other health lessons. And I suspect that it's that education that you get from being in your family, as Leah just described, that those are the tools you bring to this job and to healthcare delivery.
Yes, but you guys started, you and Tom Whitfield started the Children's Health Program. Mm-hmm. And the way I'm looking at it, you were both Yankees.
You did you ever hear Tom Whitfield talk? He's Tidewater, Virginia.
Yeah, well, yeah, Yankee land.
And I was Alabama.
Right. And so despite your adversity in living among some pretty awful people, you managed to come up with the values that you came up with. And so it is interesting that there is a, I don't know how to put this without getting into real trouble, but there is a sort of social class of people, Yankees, putting it another way, who really know what to do and know the right thing.
Well, I was privileged because I got to go with Tom to meet some of his Harvard Medical School classmates who were also in pediatrics. And I think it's the field of pediatrics in many ways that gives you a vision, or at least Harvard Medical School gave these folks a vision, and some of them, many of them were from the South, so he had compatriots in his class. This was also the class of T. Barry Brazelton, who, of course, went on to become Mr. Infancy Doctor himself. And they were all sort of post-World War II, just getting out of medical school. And I can remember going with Tom to Harvard Medical School to talk to the incoming freshman class, or whatever you call that, first class mm-hmm. medical school. And Tom was magnificent because he talked to them about, don't lose the idealism through the next 4 years of training that brought you to this point now, that each of you has a story that brought you to where you are now. You're in one of the best medical training facilities in the world, but don't lose that vision of what brought you here in the first place. And it was so powerful, and you could just see them soaking that
and
up.
And so this is the guy who started it all. Right. Here in Great Barrington, where Leah's carrying on so beautifully yes. with all of her tools and everything that she has. And we are so lucky to have somebody who has done this before and who can hit the ground running and doesn't have to Absolutely. Reinvent the wheel. But it is so interesting with every bureaucracy to sort of watch the beginning, to watch how it sort of emerged. It took, in the end, one guy to sort of think this up, right? Mm-hmm. And then you, and then all of the others, and all the way up to the Leahs, who have done such magnificent work making this thing happen. It's extraordinary. Anyway, with 5 minutes to go, what lessons would you have us learn out of all of this?
Well, the primary lesson, I think, and I say this not just here, but I say it for my colleagues in other areas of the country where I've worked, is that if you work together, the boats float higher. And I was taught when I was at MIT a very valuable lesson.
Across the river there from Harvard.
Yeah, that other place. Harvard students were operated by the zero-sum game. I win, you have to lose. MIT, we all worked together and the boats did float higher.
Whoa, I think we'll probably get some emails on this.
I think that you have to really focus on that. I think you have to hire the right people and always be looking for new and different people to bring into the organization. Don't be confined by what you think is kind of status quo for a healthcare organization. And I think just keep your eyes open, monitor the landscape. Mm-hmm. We are going to be bringing on board in July 1st a pediatric practice in Pittsfield.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And that is, we're very excited.
It's a city that really needs it.
It's our latest addition, and we're working through all the details now, but it makes it so that we will have pediatrics, dental, and medical.
And you will pay them. This is not fee for service from them to their clients.
No, this is they become CHP employees.
Employees, right.
Yes.
Gotcha. And Linda, dear Linda?
I couldn't agree with Leah more. I mean, the first in the two history notebooks that Tom kept about our beginnings, the first page is my letter to him asking if I could help with education. And the beauty of that man was if he felt as if you shared his mission, which was serve children until you can't anymore. and they turn into adults, that was what was important. And keep your eye on that goal and then bring everybody in who can help you reach that goal. And I think that's the secret. And Leah's obviously tapped into it.
Do you need a certain kind of community to do it in?
I don't think so. I think if you're good at community and real and talking to people and getting them excited about something, I think you can do it anywhere.
I don't agree. No, I don't agree. I think certain communities have it and certain don't. I think you can bring out the best of people. And you are a saint as far as I'm concerned, and so is Tom. And able to sort of see the potential for doing that. And you, Leah, are able to come into this community and not to throw out the baby with the dirty water, you know, to make sure that you see all those good things that exist around here. And also, as you just mentioned, you see where we really need the most help. South County was very important, believe me, it was. But the fact that Pittsfield, which has major leak problems, is going to get some help here. And North Adams and Adams. So you've really got your work cut out for you. And it's extraordinary that this thing continues to go in the way that it's going. We thank you, and we think that you are the best of the best. We are out of time now. And I thank you so much for being here. We've been talking with Leah Spiliotis, the Chief Executive Officer of Community Health Programs, and Linda Small, former Executive Director of CHP.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.